We're not quite ready to start yet, but one thing I'm trying to learn, it's been a while since I've been to San Diego. Any good restaurants anybody recommends? I mean, I know there are some, but plenty of them. Has anybody been anywhere they like?
Oscars.
Okay. Okay. So it's Bill's Barbecue. Phil's Barbecue. Okay, not to be confused with Bill's Barbecue.
San Diego Tap Room.
Oh, San Diego Tap Room. Anybody else?
Sea Level.
Did I hear Sea Level? Okay. I tried Tommy Arthur's, the church, and of course we all know the beer's good, but I was really impressed with his food truck. Really good. Anybody had a brewery they went to? They really were.
Society.
Beer Project.
Beer Project, Society.
Deft.
I've heard a lot about Deft. I've heard it's kind of cool because they got a meadery and a couple things and a food place. Okay. Well, good. Thanks for sharing those tips. I think it helps everybody. I am Doug Piper, and they told me, Doug, I have to stick to my script, which is terribly encumbering for me, but I will comply. My wife says I'm not a very compliant person, but we will be today. So, welcome to Boza, and I understand from Robert that I am pronouncing it right, correct? Okay, almost like the clown. Ancient sourdough fermented drink with Robert George. My name is Doug Piper. I am a member of the governing committee. Some of you may have voted for me. I appreciate that. And those that didn't, well, that's your choice. I am the founder and the host of the Gourmet Brewing Channel. And some of you may have called it either some of the live webinars or the YouTube channel. Now, before I get started, everyone take your seat. Well, y'all are very compliant. Look at you. There's almost no one standing. We also, I don't think we're going to have a problem with latecomers at this point. Make sure you silence your phone, though. This is recorded, and we don't really want to hear your cell phone go off. When you ask questions, please come up to the microphone. I know there's a real temptation to not do that, but because it's recorded, we want to hear your question. It's really, really important. We also have a QR code that we're going to demonstrate. So that QR code is one of the great ways for you to get to the other presentations from HomebrewCon and eventually when these are posted. Finally, at the end of the session, please fill out the survey, the feedback survey. As a governing committee member, I promise you we look at those and we read those. So we want to know who you recommend as was a great speaker. We also want to know where there's room for improvement. So you can find the fill out survey button at the app, and that feedback will greatly help us. So enough of all that kind of boring stuff. Let's get into Robert George. He is a resident of Nelson, British Columbia, so he's come a long ways. Distinguished master distiller and renowned expert on Boza, an ancient fermented beverage. He has a profound knowledge of fermentation, science, and traditional brewing. In his brewing techniques, he's propelled him to the forefront of the global distillery industry. And he has a particular focus on the preservation and promotion of historical drinks. Robert's expertise has made him an internationally recognized authority in the realm of traditional beverages, which I think means ancient. Thank you, and we look forward to it. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Apparently somebody has updated my Wikipedia page. I appreciate that. So, yeah, we're going to talk about Boza. That's a picture of me. You can see I'm very happy there. And that's because I'm standing next to this guy, who's largely responsible for us even being here today, Mr. Charlie Papazian. And I want to say thank you to Charlie for the opportunity. And let's give a shout out to Charlie, please. Eh? Good man, good man. In fact, Charlie is actually responsible for me being here talking to you about ancient fermented beverages, because in his book, Joy of Home Brewing, he talks about an ancient beverage called Sikaru from Sumeria. And you can see the picture of him up here. He is making the thousands of loaves of twice-baked bread called bapir that goes into the Sikaru that was made by the Anchor Brewing Company using what you can see over here is a basically a poem, but in essence a recipe for making Sikaru called the Hymn to Ninkasi. Has anybody heard of the Hymn to Ninkasi? Yeah. All right. So Anchor made the Ninkasi brew using their own yeast. It was their ale yeast. But Charlie suggests in his book that if you look at a piece of information from this fellow here, Ed Wood, you can find ancient he was a pathologist in Saudi Arabia, and he got hold of a sourdough starter, very old sourdough starter, and used it to start his business, International Sourdoughs. So this is not an advertisement for Ed Wood and his sourdoughs, but I've tried it. It works really well, and I've actually left some of the Bahrain sourdough starter from Ed Wood in the back there for you. It works really well. It's very nice. And then finally, I would like to give a shout out to one of my personal heroes, Fritz Maytag from Anchor Brewing Company, who is largely responsible for bringing back a lot of ancient beverages, not only the Sikaru, but he brought Anchor Brewing Company back from the dead practically, and he introduced porter and barley wine and IPA to the North American market. So thank you for that, Fritz. By the way, if you're ever in San Francisco, I highly recommend you go to the Anchor Brewing Company. It is a beautiful brewery, and really it's a history-making place there, and a gorgeous museum of brewing history. So let's talk about Bozo. What is it? How do you make it? Why should you drink it? This, by the way, is the Bulgarian spelling for Bosa. Bosa is very, very popular in the Balkan states, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But where does it come from? I think like many things that we take for granted in the world, like writing, mathematics, astronomy, the wheel, the sail, comes from Mesopotamia. And Mesopotamia, as we call it, the Fertile Crescent nowadays, it is the site of some of the most early developments of human civilization, going back about 10,000 BC. The arrow on this map points to a city called Uruk, and this was probably the first large metropolitan area in the world. About 100,000 people lived in Uruk at the time that it was at its height. And if you can see, it really is the crossroads in between the trade routes from Africa, from Europe, and from Asia. And it's still around. It's not a mythical place. It's really still there. This is the main temple picture there, but in its heyday, it was a large city. It was divided into neighborhoods with craft specialists because the Mesopotamian Valley was very fertile. A lot of the wild grasses that we now know as wheat, oats, rye, emmer, einkorn, all of these places, all of these products came from the wild areas around Mesopotamia, and they were domesticated. There was a shift in the Euphrates River that probably ended up killing the Uruk culture, but it was still occupied as much as 700 years ago. So let's talk about Ninkasi. We mentioned her earlier. She was a real person. She was a princess. She was the daughter of one of the kings of Uruk. She was also a priestess in the temple of Inanna. Inanna was the goddess of war and sex. That's pretty cool, interesting combination of things. But she was also the goddess of grain and of dates. Her symbol was the storehouse gates. And Ninkasi's job at the temple of Inanna was to make sure that they didn't run out of sikaru. So she was, as royalty, educated. She was literate. She was articulate. And she had a group of acolytes that helped her. She didn't make the beer herself. She taught other people to make the beer. And just as we canonize saints nowadays, in those times, someone who was an outstanding citizen would be declared a god or a goddess, and that's how she got the title of goddess of brewing. In Sumeria, you can see there are a lot of records still about how they made this beer. In the top left here, you can see that this is a recipe for beer. You take a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and then you've got some instructions about how to do it. On the bottom there, this is a pay stub, basically, from Sumeria. There was no money in those days. It hadn't been invented yet, so people were paid in goods. And in the top left, you can see this is the amount of food. There's a little food container there and some marks that say how much food this person got. The second one, you can see a beer urn there and a note of how much beer this person was paid. And then there were some other goods in there as well. There is some historical evidence of beer making, or in this case, sikaru making, in a Sumerian trading settlement called Gorin Tepe. It's in the mountains in between Iran and Sumeria, and scientists looked at the inside of these vessels and they found traces of barley, of yeast, and of bacteria. Basically, the contents of a boza recipe. It's easy to see how this technology would have moved from Mesopotamia into Asia Minor, Anatolia, or the area that we know of as Turkey right now. And boza really hit its stride about the time of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was, if you can see here, there was a lot of small tribes in Asia Minor. And this fellow, Osman I, organized all of those tribes. And he was succeeded by his son, Orhan Gazi. Orhan Gazi busied himself with conquering the rest of Asia Minor and moving out into the surrounding areas, formed something called the Yeniceri Guard, which was started out as a palace guard, but ended up being a very strong army. And you can see that they were pretty cool uniforms. They were highly armed. They were very well trained. And as one of the most famous things that Napoleon Bonaparte never said, an army travels on its stomach. And what they did was to use boza as a nutritional supplement to their goods. They were actually one of the first armies to be equipped with muskets. and thereby dominated their kingdom or empire for about 600 years, bringing their bozo with them wherever they went. Suleiman the Magnificent, you can see right here just how magnificent he was. He presided over really the heyday of the Ottoman Empire. Bozo was very popular, very strong drink at that time, sometimes 7, 8% alcohol. The army was running on it. There were 300 or 400 people in the city of Constantinople alone making boza, street vendors, boza shops. Things got pretty out of hand. People started making it super strong. They were adding opium to it. It was getting really crazy. And the whole thing kind of fell apart. And the party got shut down by the Sultan Murad, who called an end to the party in the name of purity of thought, purity of deed, closed all the boza shops, basically drove the consumption of boza kind of underground, the way homebrew making was back in the 50s, 60s here in the United States. But you can see the Ottoman Empire pretty much dominated the entire Mediterranean at that time. You notice up at the top there, that was the southern Europe, never conquered by the Ottomans, but plenty of clashes going on for hundreds of years as they skirmished back and forth trying to gain control of the Mediterranean. Need a lot of boza to keep those troops happy. It's still there. Boza is still very popular in Turkey. This is probably the most famous boza shop, Vefa Bozasisi. That basically means boza makers of Vefa. Been there since 1876. Vefa is an upscale neighborhood in Istanbul, and this place is very popular. They make hundreds of gallons of boza. They are selling hundreds of gallons of boza all of the time. Wanted to point out that they say that they're ingredients are secret, but you can do a little bit of snooping around and you can find out that it's really corn semolina, which we call polenta around here, and ground wheat. You can see in the background there that they have a line of flavored syrups as well that they sell. So let's move up north a little bit and talk about the Balkans, the Caucasus region. Just a little bit of a geographic primer for you or update. Balkans are the countries that are to the west of the Black Sea. Caucasus are the ones that are to the east of the Black Sea. In the Balkans, you've got Serbia, Romania, Croatia, Macedonia, Bulgaria, Balkanized, basically. On the opposite side of the Black Sea, it's Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia. And you can tell that this is a very straight shot from the Ottoman Empire to go up there and just conquer all of those areas and bring their boza with them. Bulgaria in particular is a very popular market for boza. There were historically people wandering the streets yelling, boza, boza. So you talk to older Bulgarians and they say, oh yeah, I remember that guy, he was really great. Sort of an interesting and wonderful memory of the boza makers in the past. But right now the boza comes in a wide variety of flavors, wide variety of sizes, lots of different brands, and all widely available in grocery stores. It's a big deal. Yeah, there's advertising and everything. Can anybody tell whether or not this was Photoshopped? Tell me if that was Photoshopped. I think it was Photoshopped. Anyway, let's talk about, go south then, and we'll talk about the Egypt and Levant areas where barley and chickpeas really take the way that they make boza. Not surprising to see boza showing up along that coastline. I looked a lot to try to find any record of boza being made in the Levant. The Levant is Jordan, Syria, Palestine, Israel, those areas. But couldn't find any, but I thought, well, what do they eat there? What do they drink there? Chickpeas just made a lot of sense for me. They've been there for 10,000 years. They're still growing there wild in Turkey. And very, very nutritious. One of the things that I just realized is that there are a lot of recipes for the stuff that you get in the can of chickpeas or when you boil it. It's called aquafaba, and it's very nutritious in itself. You can whip it up like meringue or whipped cream and use it as a condiment or put it on top of your boza. So I thought that that would be something fun to do, and that's what I did. Just to make a bit of a detour, difference between boza and buza. They're probably entomologically related from the boza from Anatolia, but it's a really different concoction. Buza is made by taking the grains, the malt, dates, honey, and baking them in loaves until they're hot and gooey inside, not fully cooked, just partially baked. And that heating process is the one that actually does the conversion of the starches into sugars. Then it used, again, with the local sourdough starters to make something. This is a boza that, or buza, sorry, that I made. It is about 7% alcohol, and it was quite sour. Kind of funny thing that I tried was to enter this into a competition, and I put it under the specialty brew category, and one of the judges sent back a note that says, it's not quaffable. Well, no, it's not, no, it's a sour. This was probably 2014 or something before people really understood what sours were and how sour beer can actually be. But very nice. And what I actually made was something called kishkab. I used lion's tail, it's a flower from East Africa, and blue lotus, which is what Odysseus's crew members got drunk on and refused to get back on the ship and were forced to go back and spear point. I was going to say gun point, but that doesn't make any sense. But you can see that there is a number of different flavors that you can add to kishkab to spark up the taste of your buza. So let's talk about sourdough starter. What is it? Let's talk about how you make it and how you use it. One of the things I wanted to just bring up about sourdough starter making boza is you've heard probably, don't eat cookie dough. Well, there's a reason for that. Cookie dough is made from raw flour, and raw flour being a natural product sometimes has some organisms in it that you don't want in there. In fact, gold medal flour was recalled not too long ago. It had some E. coli in it. But we can take care of that by pasteurizing the flour itself, put it in the oven, heat it up to 170 or so for 10 minutes. That will kill any of the organisms that are in there. And then you can add that to your sourdough culture and get something that you'll be able to eat raw. If you don't have a sourdough starter, it's really easy to make something that's going to give you a very clear flavor of boza by putting some sugar, warm water, a little bit of flour, and active dry yeast, not instant yeast, but active dry yeast. Mix that together. It'll get nice and bubbly. If you're a baker, you probably know this. And then put some yogurt in there, and I use a Bulgarian yogurt. And you've got something that you can immediately put into your boza mash. I'm not going to go through this a whole lot of detail, but the idea is that a lot of grains, especially organic grains and whole grains, have bacteria and yeast on them already, as we mentioned, and this is a way of cultivating that to increase the number of organisms in a starter. One of the things that you can see here is that you're throwing away half of it and adding more flour and water to it. This is basically to control the pH so it doesn't get too sour for the yeast. A lot of people take their flour and water mixture and just put it out in the backyard. It helps if you live in a beautiful mountain town like I do, but you can make your own, and the idea is to let some of the organisms from the air get into your sourdough starter and add their own flavors and aromas to it. It's kind of hit or miss. If you get something you like, you can continue with it. If you don't, you just dump it and start all over again. I like to use Ed Wood's sourdough starters. It takes all of the hassle out of it. They're very active and very flavorful. Here's some of the starters that he offers that I think would make a really good boza. I've used the Bahrain, the Red Sea. I have the Giza starter. I think that I'm going to be buying the Austrian and Polish starters. I'm going to try to make a boza out of rye, high rye boza, basically. So what are these? What are these critters in there? What are they? Well, yeast, obviously, and other kind of fungus strains. I just wanted to bring out three that are typically seen in boza and tend to dominate when you look at the ingredients in the starter. Research done in the past 20 years on what's in these starters. These are taken from samples of boza bought on the street, bought in shops, bought homemade. And Candida. Candida is very common. It's all over your skin. It's in your gut. The only problem with Candida is it gets into your bloodstream or gets into your private parts. It can cause a little bit of a problem. But Candida is made to ferment cacao beans, for example. And again, it's very common, very natural for it to be in your gut. Geotrichum is the organism that you see as the white crust on camembert or brie cheese. It also is very common as a gut bacteria. And, of course, our friend Saccharomyces, the sugar mold, as it's called. You can see Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which was isolated in the 1800s, who makes sweet bread that we know now, and also uvarum, which is very common on grapes. On the lactic acid bacteria, LAB, lactobacillus, of course. Has anybody made a kettle sour here? Have you used yogurt? You put some yogurt in there? Makes a very nice kettle sour. You can see plantarum down there. That is the lactobacillus species that you don't have to put a CO2 layer on your kettle to make sure that it creates a proper sour. Leuconostoc species, that's in kombucha and kefir. Again, very common as an intestinal flora. And wisela. Wisela grows naturally on grapes. It also has some antibacterial and anti-inflammatory properties that people are looking into as a probiotic on that side. So I was talking to a guy not too long ago, and I was saying, yeah, I've got this 3,000-year-old sourdough starter. And he's like, what? No way. Nothing lives that long. Well, it's true that it does live that long. It doesn't die like we die. Multicellular organisms just fall apart and stop working. Yeast, as you know, reproduces by budding, so it really doesn't have a natural death. It does, the yeast cells, there's some indication that they do kill themselves in order to provide nutrients for the colony, but for the most part, they just keep budding off. Bacteria, again, they reproduce by binary fission, sometimes as often as every 20 minutes, and there's no natural death. You can kill a bacteria, you know, stomp on it and stuff like that, but it does not have natural death. So if you control the pH and you keep feeding your sourdough starter, it'll last forever. It lasts for centuries, lasts for millennia. And we even have that. You can dry it and reconstitute it, and it will come back to life. Don't freeze it. The cells will burst, and that will kill them. But I've left some samples back there that I've just dried out, and they'll come right back to life and start up again very easily once you start feeding them again. So I'd like to just take a few minutes to talk about how I made some boza, and it's a very easy process. 4 to 1 water to grains. Put the grains in the water, simmer them for an hour, cool them down so that you can hold them, and then put that slurry into a blender and then whip it down into a very thin gruel. Put that in your fermenter, and I recommend using a stainless steel fermenter. I have a big stock pot that I use. Put it in there. Stir in a little bit of additional sugar, a little bit of water to thin it out a bit, and then keep it warm. And what I do is put the boza in the oven and turn the light on. It keeps it at around 75 to 80 degrees, and about 36 hours later, it is ready to go. I shake it out and put it through a strainer. A lot of people say use a plastic strainer. I use a metal strainer. It doesn't seem to cause any problems. And then I put it in. My household drinks a lot of fizzy water in 2-liter bottles, so we have a lot of those. I put that into the 2-liter bottles. Add a little bit of sugar, just as we use bottling sugar as home brewers, and then pop it into the fridge, and it will ferment again and make a nice fizzy drink that way. If you keep it in the tall bottles, it'll settle out, so you can get some clear boza on the top, and then it just gets progressively thicker and thicker as it gets to the bottom until you're pouring something into a mug and eating with a spoon, more like a pudding. Still very, very delicious. It tastes really nice the way it is, but you can also add some syrups to it or some other flavorings if you like. I put juice in there. I put in syrups and this kind of a thing, make it quite nice. This is my recipe for Turkish boza, the secret recipe from Vefa Boza Sisi, supposedly. I'm just guessing. But I use bulgur. I don't use whole wheat. Bulgur is a parboiled wheat. You boil that up with some corn semolina. Again, that's polenta. I use raw sugar. I buy it in bulk from the local hippie grocery, and gives it a little bit of extra interesting flavor. Put the sourdough starter in there. The 1.5 liters of water that I'm mentioning is the stuff that goes into the boil. But then you can add some more later if you like it a little bit thinner. On top, you can see a sprinkle of cinnamon, and there's which are toasted garbanzo beans, very popular snack. Balkan boza. Now, all of the Balkan countries have their own little variety. They all seem to use millet of some sort. I use yellow millet in this. Durum semolina, that's what the flour is that we make pasta out of. It's a high gluten flour, hard wheat flour. And again, with the raw sugar, sourdough starter, sprinkle of cinnamon on top. Very tasty. As I said, I couldn't find anything about how Levantine boza is made, and I decided I would go ahead and make it with chickpeas. This was probably the thickest boza that I made, and also the most boozy flavored. It was very, very strong in flavor and also in effect. I got Turkish honey. I buy it from Trader Joe's. You can use any kind of honey you want. The Turkish honey had a little bit of citrus notes in it, a little bit of wildflowers and stuff. Very nice. And then I threw some lime zest on there, just to be fun. Egyptian boza. Egyptians are known for their use of barley. Barley is a big crop in Egypt. And also dates, probably the second most important agricultural crop in Egypt. So for this one, I used date sugar. And also date syrup. I got that also from Trader Joe's. That gives it that kind of salmon look that you see there. And ajwain seed. Ajwain is a spice, again from Egypt. It's a little bit of a flavor combination of anise and oregano and thyme. If you toast it up, it's nice and fragrant. So I put a little bit on top of that Egyptian boza. It's a nutritional drink. It is basically an energy drink, and we'll talk about that a little bit. A lot of these are not hocus pocus or woo-woo stuff. They've actually done a lot of studies on the nutritional benefits of boza, and you can see that it really does a lot in terms of being a nutrition drink. You can see why the Ottoman army was so successful drinking a lot of boza. It's basically an energy drink, mostly water, the way beer is mostly water. But a lot of these are carbohydrates, says sugar up there, but basically they're the carbohydrates from the grains. Little bit of protein as well, practically no fat. The proteins, carbohydrates, fat in the different varieties of grains that go into boza are fairly well balanced, but you can see that wheat and millet and barley probably really hit the sweet spot in terms of their balance between carbohydrates, proteins, and even dietary fiber. Now, there's a difference between prebiotics and probiotics, and I'll get into that a little bit. Prebiotics are what comes from the grain and the other constituents itself. Gluten, protein, of course, from the grains. But dietary fiber, and this is actually a fairly interesting constituent of boza because there's three kinds of dietary fiber in boza. Insoluble fiber, it just goes right through you, keeps things moving, cellulose, gums, and that sort of a thing. Keeps just making sure that the contents of your intestines make it all the way through. Now, soluble fiber, this is the kind of fiber that actually attracts water, so it turns into a gel, and thereby it slows down the digestion so that you can extract more nutrients from the food that's going through your intestines. And then fermentable fibers. These are fibers that the intestinal flora can actually ferment, and they turn into things like having a senior moment there. Basically, they turn into fatty acids that feed your epithelial cells. And then resistant starch, this is something that you can't digest, but it provides a matrix so that the lacto and bifido bacteria can exist in your gut and actually provides a little bit of nutritional value to them. Now, probiotics, that's the stuff that we talk about when we're talking about yogurt, and kefir and kombucha. These are the actual live bacteria that you want to introduce into your gut for gut health. Lactobacteria, lactic acid bacteria. If there's a lot of a big population of these, then they're going to outcompete any kind of pathogen that gets in there. And they will also, because your gut is aware that they're in there, they'll keep your immune system kind of stimulated. Angiotensin-converting enzyme. I thought this was very interesting because angiotensin is a hormone that you create for that flight or fight feeling of stress, and it causes your arteries and your capillaries to tense up. Lactic acid bacteria creates angiotensin-converting enzyme that breaks down the angiotensin, and it makes your blood vessels relax, and so it lowers your blood pressure that way. So very good stuff. So, okay, you've made your boza, you're ready to drink it, you're ready to save it. Let's talk a little bit about how you would keep boza. It's, of course, temperature dependent. It's alive, and just like you keep your buttermilk or your yogurt in the fridge, you keep your boza in the fridge as well. And it'll last quite a long time, 10, 15 days. So I've had it 3 weeks. I forgot about it in the fridge. It was in there, pulled it out. It was great. And this is because the lactic acid bacteria continues to ferment in there, continues to lower the pH, and that in itself allows you to keep your boza longer because the shelf life is increased. It does change in flavor, much as our homebrew changes if we let it lager or we keep it a while in the kegerator. The flavor kind of improves and matures, just like beer. Now, the researchers that were playing around with the different constituents of boza found three separate species that they thought provided the best flavor. And so these are the ones. If you can find these, the Lucana stock and the Weselia cultures, so you could make yourself some very, very nice boza from those. I use the sourdough starters, and I find them to be quite tasty. Boza is a winter drink, especially in Turkey. It's called a winter drink, but they don't serve it warm. It's actually kind of more like an eggnog, but they really still consider it a nutritional, warming beverage, and it's drunk almost universally in the winter. In the summer, it doesn't last very long, so a lot of the boza vendors switch to lemonade. But it's typically considered this really nice thing that you drink in the winter. In Turkey, they also use something called pekmez or fruit molasses. This is very easy to make. Take grape juice. I use white grape juice. Boil it down to 10 to 30% of its original volume. And you've got a molasses-like thing that you can just add to your boza. They also, in Turkey, make different flavors of boza. We've got figs. We've got sugar beets. We've got juniper, mulberries. All of these can be turned into a nice flavored syrup to add to your boza. Talked about leblebi. It's very, very easy to make. Take a can of chickpeas, drain it, save the drains liquid, dehull it, dry them in like a dish towel or a tea towel, take the hulls off, add some flavoring. I like to use avocado oil, sea salt, lime peel, or lime zest. And then bake it in the oven until they're nice and crispy, crunchy. And this is a very popular snack in Turkey. This Bohem Snite, that means Bohemian Dream in Bosnian. And this is a sort of like a tiramisu. It's a chocolate cookie mixed with custard and layered on top with some chocolate sauce. And this is something like you would have for at tea time or as a snack. Banitsa, which is basically a Bulgarian word meaning cheese pie, phyllo dough, yogurt, Macedonian feta cheese rolled together, really good. Quite a nice, very flavorful breakfast meal in Bulgaria. So that's kind of like to just leave you with saying, as they say in Bulgaria, Nazledete se na vashata boza. Enjoy your boza. So thank you. Appreciate you all coming here, and look forward to talking to you or answering any questions you might have.
So what's the texture of boza? Like, is it
thicker or? It varies from, and as I mentioned earlier, you can layer it out, so it becomes thin at the top and progressively thicker at the bottom. You can make it less grainy by whirling it in a blender for a little bit longer. But it's kind of like a pudding as you're eating it towards the bottom of the vessel that you're containing it in.
Cool. Thanks.
Yeah, sure.
Hello, and thank you. That was very interesting.
Thank you.
The recipes that say 150 milliliters of starter to add.
Uh-huh.
How do you make 150 milliliters out of the dry weight?
Are going to build that. For those of you that got a sample, put it in like a spice mill to chop up the little pieces, and then use the directions for building it up. You're going to add flour and water, and just keep building it and building it until you've got perhaps a quart or so of starter that you can keep in your refrigerator.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
For the dried sourdough starter, what's the best way to rehydrate it?
I would take that, as I said, take the pieces that you have, whirl them in like a small food processor perhaps, or a spice mill if you have it, or an electric coffee mill. Mm-hmm. That'll make the pieces a little bit smaller. Then add about 150 milliliters of warm water, not hot, just tepid water, stir it up until everything is dissolved, and then start feeding it with half flour, and I encourage you to use the pasteurized flour we talked about. Half flour, half water. Every 12 hours or so, add a little bit more until you've got a substantial amount of starter to work with.
So roughly what's in that bag to 150 mils of water?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, half a cup or so, yeah.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. And then just keep building it up over time.
This Hi. Is really interesting. Hi. I was curious, what are the sanitation requirements you would recommend for storing boza if it's only going to be lasting, say, 2 or 3 weeks in a refrigerated environment?
Sanitation requirements?
Right. So would this be like on the level of bottling a beer, or is this more like, hey, use a clean bottle, rinse it out, but it doesn't need to be like, you know, filled with star sand and fully sanitized?
It doesn't need to be. You know, it's a nice insurance policy. I use star sand, squirt it in there. I use star sand in a spray bottle, mm-hmm. you know, so there's about a tablespoon or two, swirl it around. And the same thing with when you are, for your fermenter as well.
Okay.
Just to be safe, go ahead. You know, I've done it without, and it seems to work fine. But a lot of people say a sourdough starter starts to drift as well.
Oh, okay.
You know, it does start to drift because we're bathed in microbes, let's face it.
Right.
So if you do the kind of sanitation procedures that you do with homebrew, it'll last longer that way, for
okay.
sure.
Can you sour mash a boza? So can you take, like, the last cup of your previous batch and add that to your new, to your
yes,
latest?
Yeah. I did not talk about that, but that is indeed how it is done in the in Turkey and in the Balkans. About 4%
okay.
of the volume in the previous batch.
Right.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome. Hi.
Hi. I want to know, is there a recommended serving size? We're used to drinking pints of beer. Is it, you know, a 6-ounce pour? What did you have in your illustration?
You know, I find that like a 12-ounce glass is nice.
Okay.
And sometimes I find that, I think I'll have a bit more.
All right.
You know?
Okay.
So, yeah, 12 ounces. You saw those glasses
exactly.
in there with the bomb.
Exactly. I wasn't certain how big those were.
That's about it. Yeah,
okay.
that's typical.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you for your talk.
Hey, yes.
In commercial varieties of boza
yes.
That you showed, what is the typical APV? And then on your homemade,
uh-huh.
what is it? And then is there any way to keep that under control?
The typical ABV in commercial boza is around 1% to 2% at the max. I know that in Bulgaria, Bosnia, they give it to the kids. And of course, in France, they give wine to the kids, so that doesn't tell you a whole lot, but it's not considered a highly alcoholic beverage. Same in Turkey, less than, 2%, probably more like 1%. I've done it up to, it's probably around 3% or 4%. Depends, again, how long you let it ferment in the primary. And once it goes into the fridge, it doesn't seem to really get much stronger. So my recommendation would be to get it where you want it and then get it into the fridge. I put some bottling sugar in there, but that's mostly just to balance the sourness with a little bit of sweetness. Okay. Well, great. Thanks so much for coming. I really appreciate it. Thank you.